Thank you very much, and I want to thank all the organizers for putting together this very nice workshop, and also for inviting me to participate here. So I want to tell you about some line of work which has been ongoing for me for a couple of years by now, and which is to find some direct connections or to very concretely relate to popular approaches to describing strongly correlated or strongly entangled quantum matter. One of them being the partons, which we just heard about fairly extensively, and the other one being a method which is sometimes called the coupled wire construction, which has become fairly popular in the last couple of years. So the kind of things we want to describe, as in many of the previous talks, are phases which are strongly entangled, but that we usually mean something which should not, based on common sense, be realized based on our macroscopic ingredients, right? So we have, say, charges, charge one objects, and if we throw a bunch of them together, we expect to get integer charged objects. We don't typically expect something that carries fractional charge. And that's something which is certainly not possible if we just throw together some finite number of integer charged objects locally. So something more serious needs to happen, which means that if you try to describe phases where it empirically seems to happen, like quantum Hall states or quantum spin liquid states, then we need some kind of method which allows us to encode this kind of intrinsic non-locality or this intrinsic entanglement. So we cannot just, by the very nature of the problem, get away with just doing some local mean field theory based on whatever microscopic degrees of freedom we may have. So that's why new technology was developed, the one being the partons and the second one being coupled wires. And I obviously cannot explain to you in detail any of these techniques, but I want to just give a philosophical point of view. What's the idea behind these approaches? What's the difference? And then how can we relate the two? So I'll begin with partons. So in some sense, partons are based on a state rather than a specific Hamiltonian. So the first step can be viewed as dreaming up some quantum state or some wave function. There are very well-known examples, for example, the Laughlin state over here, or something like a projected Fermi C, where we just take a Fermi surface formed by spin-filled fermions and project such a state down to having only a single fermion per side to get a wave function to describe a spin system. So we have such a kind of state, and it's quite useful to reinterpret this kind of state, or these kind of wave functions, as some kind of product of things which are simple, right? As a product of weakly entangled wave functions. So, for example, if I'm taking this Laughlin state, I can just write it as a product of a certain number of integer quantum Hall states. So, in this sense, at least, we're relating something more complicated to something simpler. And we can do something similar for the spin wave function also. And once we have this kind of description, it's very natural to try to encode such a state by what's known as a parton construction. In this case, my microscopic object, meaning my electron, is just written as some product over new objects, new fermions, which are the ones that in this wave function will form the integer quantum Hall states. Right? So in some sense, it's really kind of literally doing this kind of decomposition directly on the lattice scale, and then you can see where this is going to lead you. So this gives you an operatorical way of, of writing out these partons. So you might feel tempted to just take this thing and put it into your Hamiltonian. And okay, so now you would appear to have a way to describe Hamiltonians. But of course, what happens if you actually take this and plug it in is you're going to get a Hamiltonian which has no Gaussian term for the fermion. There's no bilinear term for it. Right? So you have essentially a Hamiltonian where the Gaussian part is zero, and you're trying to do a mean field perturbation, if you want, around this zero Hamiltonian, which is by its very nature as uncontrolled as anything can be. Right? So you definitely not have any hope of capturing any kind of non-universal stuff, which means what phase is actually realized. That's unfortunately not universal. But what you can get is answers to questions like, is the state which I have dreamed up compatible as a matter of principle with the properties of my Hamiltonian? Is it compatible with, say, the symmetries which I want, with the kind of microscopic degrees of freedom that I have available, and so on? Right? So this is, if that's the thing you care about, then partons are amazing. And that's what we already heard quite extensively in Chong's talk and also in the last talk right now. But if you care about the question, what kind of microscopic model do I need to realize the state which I have dreamed up, then you're out of luck, because this method doesn't really give you much insight into this question. So that's kind of what it is. Now, the second approach, the coupled wire construction, is instead based on Hamiltonians. So the first stop is you start with some lattice Hamiltonian, say, which you, of course, can't solve. So instead of solving it, you just turn off all the couplings, say, in the vertical direction. Right? So once I've done that, I have a bunch of one-dimensional theories, which are the wires, hence the name. And these one-dimensional models, you typically know how to solve. So for each of these one-dimensional models, we then take the long wavelength limit, which is usually known. And in many cases, so in the simplest cases, it's just taking the form of a Luttinger liquid, some one-dimensional free boson theory. And the hope is somehow that the degrees of freedom which we have over here, which have already eliminated lots of short distance physics, brings us a little bit closer to the kind of degrees of freedom which will eventually describe the low energy physics of my full two-dimensional phase. So once I've done that, well, I could try to turn back the original Hamiltonian. That, of course, doesn't help me very much because I still can't solve it. So what you do instead is you write down a subset of the terms of the Hamiltonian, or you write down a fixed point Hamiltonian, which you can actually solve and form a two-dimensional phase of matter. So in practice, that means that you find a set of conjugate variables, which are just some local linear combinations of the microscopic variables I have over here, with a bunch of conditions. Firstly, the Hamiltonian is just supposed to be a sum of terms which commute. That's kind of the condition. If I have that, then I can solve the model. So I have a kind of exactly solvable model. These things better be local operators, because I want to operate with the right degrees of freedom. So any term in my Hamiltonian I'm going to write down should be locally expressible in terms of whatever I had microscopically. Okay, these objects should be commute. And if I look at the ground state of this model, which can be characterized by all of these fields here sitting in the minimum of the cosine, then I want this state to be symmetric under whatever symmetries I may care about. Right? These are a bunch of conditions. And it turns out that trying to satisfy all of them for a given model is a somewhat cumbersome algebraic task. Go and sort it out. And moreover, there's not typically unique solutions. So for any model with this, you can have many possible states. And there's very little guidance a priori what kind of phase you're going to get by writing down these kind of fixed point Hamiltonians. So, yes?
What,
four? Where's four? Oh, OK. So I have some, like, once I have such a Hamiltonian here, I know what my ground state looks like. Right? The ground state is given by some combination of pin fields. And I want this to be, for example, if I care about symmetric states, I want this ground state to be invariant under a symmetry. Right? I don't want to enforce this on the Hamiltonian, because that would still give me the possibility of breaking the symmetry spontaneously. So you actually need to enforce it on the state. OK, so but now, so this is kind of what you require to do, a lot of work. But say you found such a Hamiltonian. So that allows you now access, in a very controlled way, to such an hopefully interesting quantum phase, which is in the following sense. If I have my model of decoupled wires that has many gapless degrees of freedom, and typically there are many, many relevant directions. So it can flow in all kinds of possible ways. But if we find a fixed point Hamiltonian, then we can always find one trajectory getting from this decoupled wire fixed point in some recoupling way that will end up in a point where all of these guys have flown to strong coupling and everything else becomes irrelevant. And since this one describes a fully gapped phase, you know, all our d directions will drive inwards. So we have a little bit of wiggle room from our original model to still end up at the same kind of fixed point. And so we have a fixed point Hamiltonian, and we have, a matter of principle, a direct route to reach this new fixed point Hamiltonian directly from the weakly correlated starting point by some RG flow. This is kind of the gist of coupled wires. And what we've seen is there are certainly advantages and disadvantages between these two. And the goal of this talk is to combine, to get from one to the other, and to maybe get rid of some of the disadvantages. Now, specifically, what I'm going to use is some duality transformation on the wire models. And what it will allow me to do is to eliminate this thing over here, that the fact that we have to construct these fixed point Hamiltonians in some kind of unguided piece-by-piece spaces by instead using direct insight from partons to get the fixed point Hamiltonian for the kind of phase that we may be interested in. OK, so I'll give you two examples for this approach. The first one is kind of oldish work I was doing with Jason and Lessig from Caltech on quantum Hall states. So I'll go briefly to that, and then I'll talk about some newer work on spin systems. So in the quantum Hall effect, we are interested in problem of electrons in the field. So we can decompose it into partons in the simplest way. I'll write my electron in terms of four fermions. Two of them I'll just put in some integer quantum Hall state. At that point, the last fermion will be my composite fermion. It lives in a different magnetic field. So it can, for example, form the Fermi C, but there's some effective field left over. And then when I form mean field state of these composite fermions, either by pairing or integer quantum Hall states, then I'm getting instantly a very large number of the fraction quantum Hall states. That's kind of a very simple way of getting a lot of fraction quantum Hall states from partons in like 30 seconds. Now, the second approach, coupled wires, has been developed in the last 15 years for this thing, is significantly more complicated. So in this case, we have electrons. So each one-dimensional wire I'm starting with is just going to be a large integer liquid model. And I'm just setting all kind of coupling constant to one just to make things look simple, right? So we just have electrons coupled to a gauge field, which is just viewed to be static. It's an external gauge field which contains magnetic field, for example, and that's my model. And then we couple them together by some fixed point Hamiltonian to get quantum Hall states. So in this case, it was first done for the fractional quantum, for the abelian fractional quantum Hall states by Charlie Kay and his collaborators, and much later for the non-abelian ones. And what you find is Hamiltonians which look something of this type. That's the fixed point Hamiltonian in the wire language for the Laughlin state. It contains hopping of electrons and some kind of interaction term. So it's some fairly complicated correlated Hamiltonian, which is maybe not obvious why that should be describing the Laughlin state. And you know, so if you try to get the non-abelian ones, you can imagine that you'll find something which is significantly more complicated than that. So now we want to...
Is that local?
This over here? Yes. Yeah. So in my notation, so the electron is local kind of because it's an electron. Now here, in this convention, I have my convention up over here, right? That's my electron. So since the factor of two here makes it local. All right. So now I want to kind of reproduce this knowledge about the fractional quantum Hall states by doing the parton or the flux attachment on my lattice variables. And the key player in this is a vortex operator. So you can write down operator of this type. It's in the exponential, it's a sum over all my lattice heights with the density with some particular function. And the main property is a function that it winds by 2 pi as you go in a closed circle around the origin. That's a vortex operator. If you drag around a chart, it will pick up a phase of 2 pi. Now in the wire language, I just replace the density by whatever the density is in terms of my variables. And then I can make a choice. This alpha only needs to satisfy the fact that it winds. And it turns out that for the wires, one could make a particular simple choice that the vortex actually only looks like a one-dimensional string object over here. So I no longer have a sum over my entire space, but only over a single one-dimensional string. And now if I combine two of these vortices sitting on neighboring wires, it is again a local object which I can write down. Right? So this vortex hopping is now nicely local. And now if I go back to the Laughlin state written over here, and let me go specifically to the case where n equals 1, then this Hamiltonian can be reinterpreted as one where the electron hops, and at the same time, there are two vortices which hop from the original location to a different location. Right? So we have a correlated process, an electron hops, and a vortex hops, and that's exactly what one would think about in terms of composite fermions. If I now define the composite fermion as just being an electron and two vortices, then in terms of this new degrees of freedom, I'm getting a Hamiltonian which looks again like a band structure model. It looks just like hopping of composite fermions.
So the composite fermion operator itself is not local, but the hopping is.
That's exactly right, yes. Right. So this gives me now a general strategy for constructing all of these models over here in the following way. I'm thinking about mean field state of electrons. They're local in terms of electrons. Now, wherever I see electrons, I just replace them by a composite fermion. So it gives me a very different model. And then I'm using this identity to translate this back into a model of electrons. So this procedure automatically is guaranteed to generate for me a model that is local in terms of electrons, right? Simply because the individual hopping process of composite fermions is local, so any larger process is also local. And that turns out to generate for me all of the abelian quantum Hall states and the non-abelian quantum Hall states, and without doing this kind of cumbersome approach, but just kind of turning the crank and putting as input the very simple models for mean field states, you know, integer quantum Hall states, BCS superconductors, and so on. And of course, in this case, it doesn't gain us anything new. These Hamiltonians have been known, but it can be viewed as kind of the way to check that this approach indeed works. You have now a way to transcribe your composite fermion approach of putting composite fermions into mean field states in order to get these kind of fixed point Hamiltonians. So that's the one thing you can do. You can actually do it a little bit more, and you can get the emergent gauge fields which the partons are telling you to get, in particular for the gapless phases. So for that, let me just take this model over here. I've turned off all the couplings, so it's just this decoupled wire model. And now I'm translating this model into the variables for the composite fermions, right? So it's some non-local transformation, so I'm getting some horribly non-local Hamiltonian. It's quadratic, it's quadratic and contains only like derivative terms, but it's non-local. And now the key point is the observation that if you have this object here, this non-local Hamiltonian, you can write it exactly as some Gaussian integral over some auxiliary variable in terms of these things. Right? So that's not doing all that much. But the structure which you get over here turns out to be particularly simple and appealing. Namely, it is a structure of these variables where it's now local. It's coupled to some to the auxiliary field in a manner like coupling to a gauge field. And in this particular case, what you get is a Chern-Simons term on this lattice for the gauge field. Right? So this is now an exact rewriting of this model over here in the sense that the partition function for these two models are exactly equivalent.
That's what you're doing that on each wire? I mean, you're adding a gauge field.
No. So I have my Hamiltonian over here. This one is for every, it has like all of these have wire indices. Right, this is for any given wire, and then this term here has a derivative which connects different wires.
Did you put that in by hand
or not? No, I kind of derive it in this way. As a matter of practice, the simplest way, since in this case we know the answer, is to guess this object over here to be of that form, perform this integral, and show that it's indeed the non-local object which you get by just blindly plugging in the operator transformation. And so there's nothing doing by hand here. This is just an equivalent, kind of a very complicated but equivalent way of describing the model of decoupled wires. So schematically, what we've done here is that we've taken the original equations of freedom, which are just locally coupled to engage field again, just for the wires. We only have the time direction and the x direction, but nothing in the y direction, which we can show is exactly identical to this model over here, where we have the new degrees of freedom, again, locally on the wires, time direction and space direction. And now there's an additional term which couples together these different wires. So over here, the degrees of freedom are correlated across wires. And over here, they're not. But they're equivalent models. Now, once we have this, we can then turn on the composite fermion hopping, which we've already shown is a local process. And by that, we can get a theory for like compressible states, for example, for the composite fermion liquid. And it turns out one can even do it to get this Dirac composite liquid theory, which people have been interested in recently. So this kind of completes the connection between the wires and the partons. We now have really a way to transcribe everything that we like to do with the partons. We get all the gap states as mean field states of the partons. And as well, we get the gapless states, and we get the emergent gauge field. So that's kind of all I'm going to say about this first part, about the quantum Hall part. So before I move on, are there any questions about this?
When you say you can obtain the Dirac composite fermion liquid, do you mean after you do this, the Hamiltonian for the composite fermion is a Dirac?
Well, so that depends on how I put in the hopping. So I can, right? So I can put down the initial correlated hopping terms in this Hamiltonian over here, demand a certain symmetry, and once I translate this back to the other side, the same symmetry will ensure that I'm actually getting a Dirac dispersion for these kind of these composite fermions. Yes?
When you say Fasnacht theory, you seem to refer to the same as Fasnacht attachment at least
in this particular case, yes, that's right.
And generally, Fasnacht can be more generic.
That's very good. So firstly, once I've done this, I can of course do it in a hierarchical way. I can kind of keep doing that. But in the next stage, I'll do something which looks more like a general pattern construction, not specifically flux attachment. That's right. Anything else? All right. So then I'll move on to my second example, which is in the realm of quantum magnetism. So specifically, I'll be talking about spin 1/2 degrees of freedom with only SZ being conserved, or equivalently bosons on some lattice at half filling. And that's the work of my student Eyal Leviathan. And what you'll find is that many of the things I'm going to describe will mirror things that have been discussed some 15 years ago in these original works on deconfined criticality and many of the follow-up works. This is kind of the second test case for making these connections, where we again know already a fair number of things. So that's my system. I'll mainly phrase things in terms of bosons because the language is a little bit simpler. So firstly, we have some trivial phases, which you may care about. We can have a nil state of the spins, or equivalently a superfluid of my bosons. These are both states where the continuous U1 is broken. Or I can have states where the U1 is preserved, but I'm breaking some spatial symmetries, like a valence bond state for my spins, where I'm just forming singlets and covering my entire system, or in the bosons, where I'm putting bosons on certain bonds and not on other bonds to have some kind of state with uniform density, but non-uniform energy density. These are kind of trivial phases. And the first thing that we should probably do when we try to describe all of this stuff in wires is to make sure that we are able to correctly characterize the trivial phases. So let's now follow the wire program. We have one-dimensional wires. They're again described by the slot in the liquid. And there's, in principle, there can be this kind of term over here, some cosine term with a specific coefficient, which can drive this one-dimensional system into a one-dimensional valence bond crystal or a one-dimensional bosonic density wave state. Now, I will typically assume initially that this guy is irrelevant at the decoupled wire fixed point, and then we'll see later on where it will be important to include it back in. So I'll mostly be working with this one, and if you were worried about this one, I'll get back to it a little bit later. So this is my model. I have my one-dimensional wires. And the leading coupling terms I can write down, leading in the RG sense at the decoupled fixed point, are just the hopping of bosons to neighboring wires, or this is some kind of density interaction between bosons, again, on neighboring wires. So I have my decoupled wires. I have now various relevant directions. And let me first focus on the case where this one is the most relevant one. I'm forgetting about the guy over there. This one flows to strong coupling, so I can just make sure that these phases are always lying in the minimum of the cosine. And this leaves me with some soft mode where I'm just having the difference between neighboring phi variables varying very little. So that gives me potentially a derivative in the y direction for the phi variable. Now, if I further write down my Hamiltonian here in this Lagrangian form in terms of the phi variable also, we can easily see that the total Hamiltonian is just del mu phi squared, or in other words, the action of a superfluid mode. So that's good. That's the superfluid. That's what we expect to get. And that's indeed what we get. Now, on the other one, we can do essentially the same. There's one small subtlety because I've chosen this guy with the plus over here. It's convenient to make a small redefinition to go from theta to minus 1 to the y theta. Essentially, that just puts a minus over here. Doesn't affect this Hamiltonian or this action when expressed in terms of theta. And again, we're getting some kind of elastic model, some del mu theta squared, which is some gapless theory. And this is not what we expect, right? We expected a valence bond state. But what this described is nothing but a phonon mode of the density wave. So I formed a density wave, but I can, within this model, just do smooth fluctuations, which describes me the phonon. And that's because I have ignored this H prime term. Now, once I put this term back in, it's essentially the same thing as enforcing that I do have a lattice in the system that will pin the phonon mode, right? We can just take this model add this kind of term, it's strongly relevant, and it will pin this variable theta prime to lie in the minimum of a given cosine. So in that sense, we do get both the gap, the superfluid state, and the fully gapped density wave state. So the trivial states. And now to get to the non-trivial ones, the perspective is to use topological defects. And so the first one that we can write down is just the vortex. It's exactly the same operator as before, because we can give bosons that can form a superfluid. The vortex is the same. The only difference is I have a factor here just because my convention is a little bit different. They are again coupled to some Maxwell photon in exactly the same way as I described before. You can, you know, rewrite your Hamiltonian in terms of vortex variables. You'll find non-locality, and you can recast it as something coupled to a gauge field, and there will be a Maxwell term for that gauge field. But now there's a subtlety, which is that the vortex can only hop in steps of two. Right? The leading term that we have is the cosine, now the sum of two neighboring terms, and since any one of them will hop a vortex across one wire, we now have hopping of vortices from one wire to the next neighboring wire, and so on. So if I just have these terms, I have some emergent conservation that I have two species of vortices that don't talk to each other. And that's, again, perfectly expected. If I'm thinking about bosons, vortices that see the bosons as fluxes, and I have half filling, so I have pi flux per lattice, I'm expecting two valleys where my vortices live in. And so again, I get two species of vortices at sufficiently low energies. Yeah.
So it hops in steps of two because step one hopping is forbidden?
Well, so this term is not allowed. This term is not a local term in my model. Okay. So it's not allowed. Right?
Ah, local.
Yeah. Okay. Right, so local terms are essentially all of these. Right, so that's a local term I can have.
Oh.
So that's okay, so now that you asked it, I can already mention it. So this is an allowed term, but you can see there's a factor of two over here. So a single vortex can't tunnel from one valley to the next, but two vortices can change the species. So it's not kind of a total conserved charge, it's a conserved, you know, Z2 charge.
What if you change the periodic potential so that there'd be one boson per every well? So that, I think, gets rid of the factor of two.
Yeah, if I exactly. If I have if I had integer filling, I just remove this factor of two over here.
Yeah.
And then I have normal boson vortex duality.
Yeah.
But okay, that I don't care about right now. I care about the half-filled case.
So if you have one third filling, then it's like hopping will be step three.
If I have what?
Have one third filling.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Right, so I have two kind of an emergent two species of vortices. So if I combine these two statements, I should actually write down my wire model as two types of vortices that are coupled to a gauge field. Right, these are my low energy degrees of freedom. These vortices can hop. They have some interaction. So overall, this describes, in terms of degrees of freedom, something like a field theory of two bosons coupled to an emergent gauge field. And that's, again, something very familiar to people who have been thinking about describing this Neel 2 VBS transition. These are kind of very natural variables in order to describe the transition. So now let me talk about a different kind of defect, which I can also have, which is the defect in the second type of phase in my model, which is like a dislocation in my density wave state. Right? The structure is very similar. It's, again, something of this type. The only difference, there's some sign difference over here, which, again, just related to the different signs in the cosines. So this one creates a single defect in the charge density wave. And now it has a property that if I'm combining two bosons on neighboring sites, all the strings cancel, and I just get the physical boson I started with. Because now we have something which looks very, very similar to some of a Parton construction. We explicitly have an expression where our physical boson is expressed in terms of these two new variables, this B1, B2 bosons.
And these little Bs carry charge, do they?
That's a very good question. You know, what kind of charge do they carry? You know, from this one, we can see that they combine two of them together, carry charge one. Now, what charge individually they carry is a little bit ill-defined because they're non-local objects. But you know, if you are in a phase which is symmetric in some sense, then you may expect that they should each carry a charge one half. right? Which is, you know, it's roughly analogous to when you're thinking about defects in the valence one state, right? You know the defect there carry a spin 1/2, which is, again, just it's a loose analogy to what we have over here, where these bosons are in principle capable of each carrying a spin 1/2, a charge of 1/2. But it's equally conceivable to have a phase where one of them carries a full charge and the other one is neutral. Right? This are just operators, so we haven't really specified what state we're acting in. Now, again, we have two species that kind of follows trivially from this line over here. If this boson hops, the guy in the middle cancels. So we have two species of bosons. They are, again, going to be coupled to some kind of gauge field. So I have bosons coupled to a gauge field. I have hopping of the bosons. And as a final observation, if I take this operator over here, this can be equivalently expressed as the vortex in the vortex. Right, so I take my one of my vortex operators, I have two of them, and each of these boson operators is just the defect in one of these vortices. This is mainly, it's maybe a little bit confusing, it's mainly related to this perspective of getting these bosonic partons by doing sequences of dualities on bosons, which is has been known for a long time in this deconfined criticality story. All right, so now if we compare these two theories, they look very similar. In both cases, we have bosonic degrees of freedom coupled to gauge fields. These can hop. There are two of them, but there's one big difference, which is the role of this extra term, this pinning term, this H prime. So as I already mentioned when Chang was asking the question, there's this term which allows two vortices of one species turn into two vortices of the other species. So it's some kind of local term in this field theory. But if I'm looking at what this guy does on the other side, it turns out to be non-local. And specifically, what it does, it inserts a certain amount of flux of this gauge field over here. So if, okay, that seems, what does it mean, flux insertion? It means that if I have a gauge field which is real, and that's always what this construction gives me. I'm always introducing my gauge field as a Gaussian integral, so it's always over all real variables. But I have an explicit monopole operator in my theory. It's equivalent in some sense to having actually a compact gauge field in the model. Right? So a gauge field where I don't have a Maxwell term, but kind of a cosine of the Maxwell term. Which is exactly in the same way as for the XY model, we know that if we have kind of cosine of some difference, we can express it as just a Gaussian part and an explicit vortex creation operator. And so in that sense what we have. So this is really just reproducing stuff that has been known for a long time. We can use these bosonic partons, and what we get is a field theory, two partons coupled to a compact gauge field as expected. All right.
So the gauge field on the right is non-compact.
That's right. OK, good. So we have kind of what we think are the right degrees of freedom. We have the right structure of the gauge field, right? Bosons coupled to some gauge field. And now we can try to use them to describe various phases. And there's a number of phases that are expected based on parton thinking. Firstly, there are trivial phases, which I already described a few of. Then there are chiral phases. If there is an induced transignment term for the emergent gauge field, then that's a way how the system can avoid confinement. We can have a Higgs mass for the gauge field. Again, that will avoid confinement. Or, in matter of principle, we can be gapless, and that, you know, may or may not avoid confinement as well. So we've already seen a bunch of examples. And now we can just write down the fixed point Hamiltonian in a pretty simple way. Right? Firstly, we already know this, the fixed point Hamiltonians for these kind of states. That's the first thing I described. And we can transcribe them into these new variables. And it's not very surprising that what we're going to find is insulating phases for vortices and these kind of partons, or superfluid phases for these partons. That's maybe the simplest part. Next, we can have chiral phases. And they're, again, not super illuminating. I can just write down a quantum Hall state for these vortices or a quantum Hall state for these partons. And I can transcribe that back. And I'm finding something what I recognize to be the fixed point Hamiltonian for some bosonic quantum Hall state or for some chiral spin liquid state. And finally, I can go to something maybe slightly more interesting, like a Z2 spin liquid. And for that, what I expect to do is just condense a certain object, namely a vortex of the one type. And in my condensation, it's an anti-vortex of the second type. but individual vortices are not condensed. Right? That's a kind of phase which I would expect to give me a Z2 spin liquid, and I can do a similar thing with my bosonic partons. Again, I'm condensing kind of a particle hole excitation, but I'm not condensing any individual bosons. So I've just told you that this is what I get. I just write down fixed point Hamiltonians for this object, and I'm getting something which I call a Z2 spin liquid. So how do I know? If I just apply this program, I'm generating these phases, how do I know what I have? Well, the first one is the answer is already known. Right? For simple phases, it's known, so that I can just check it off my list. The second, for the chiral phase, I can look at edge states. I just write Hamiltonian, I just put it in a finite system. I look what the edge state is, and that allows me to identify my state. But then there's the most general one, which is actually look at quantum numbers and statistics of excitation. But that's how we typically define our topological phases. So now I have my fixed point Hamiltonian, and I have my ground state, where all of these variables are just sitting in my at a fixed value, right? So just sitting at zero in all of space. Now, an excitation of this model will be a configuration where this remains unchanged in all locations except one particular one, where I'm creating a domain wall where the cosine interpolates from one minimum to second minimum. Right? So that's some excitation, and I can write down some operator that creates some excitation in my system generically. And now, once I have such an operator, I can just combine them into something like a braid, right? I'm moving particles around in some way that they interlink. And then just from the commutation of these operators, I'm getting some statistical phase. And this allows me to identify, for example, the quasi-particles of fractional Hall states, but also the mutual statistics of the magnetic and the charged particle in the Z2 spin liquid. Right? So once I have the Hamiltonian, it's a pretty simple exercise to verify that these excitations have certain statistics, and also to compute what their quantum numbers are. But maybe one of the more interesting things is to asking how do these partons, these objects, deconfine? Because at the end of the day, I always have the same operator. I've defined this thing to be the parton, and I'm saying that in some phases this object should be confined, in some it could be deconfined. So how do I actually see that? And so first I should see that in a trivial phase, like density wave, this guy better be confined. And so the density wave state is one where all these theta variables are just pinned at zero. And now I'm acting on such a state with this operator. Now what this operator does, it puts a domain wall into every single of these theta fields. Right? For every single y, I'm having some domain wall, either one going up or going down. And since each domain wall will give me some finite energy cost, this thing will create for me an excitation, has an energy cost which is linearly in system size. So this object here is energetically confined in such a system, which is what we expect. So that's maybe not the surprising part. One can play some similar game with the superfluid, where the phase is pinned, and then the ground state is just an eigenstate of this operator. So in that case, this bosonic parton is actually condensed, which is, again, the kind of thing we expect. But now let's do something more interesting, and let me write down the simplest possible model for a Z2 spin liquid. So here I have two types of cosines. Right, one involving the theta fields, one involving the phi fields. And now let me write down this bosonic parton operator. Right? It's a string of things, so it's just a sum over all these terms sitting in my exponential. And I want to operate with that on my ground state. So it looks like a bit of a mess, but I can identify this object here. Let me just call it capital phi. And the rules of the game is, since in my ground state, the ground state is an eigenstate of this operator over here, whenever I identify this operator in this huge sum, I can just cross it out and set it to zero. Right? So I've done that over here. I have this big sum. I replace it as a big sum of these guys. And only at this particular point, there's something non-trivial, which means that when I'm acting with the operator on the ground state of this Hamiltonian, it's the same as acting just with this little local operator on the same ground state. And now if I'm acting with a local operator, I'm only going to get a local energy cost. So this is on this ground state, we indeed have a deconfined parton excitation. And you can likewise compute the energy being 1/2.
Sorry, I may have missed what you said. Mm-hmm. Did you have a recipe to figure out what kind of cosine term you want to add?
if I didn't say I want to get a Z2 spin.
That's right, yeah. That's I mean, if you missed it, then that was that's kind of almost the main point of the talk.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So good that you ask. So the recipe is precisely this. The recipe is, I know how to write down, it's not that difficult, Hamiltonian that realizes this, that kind of forms this kind of exciton condensate, right? It's just like some kind of condensation Hamiltonian. So I write that down in terms of, you know, some objects. Then I, whenever I see these objects, I call them vortices, and then use my dictionary to translate that from some Hamiltonian of these variables into one for those variables. And that turns out to give me, in this case, this kind of Hamiltonian.
That term is local,
yes. I mean, you can kind of see that this, and it, like these terms are all local on their own, like phi minus phi, and over here, theta plus theta was local, so they're just kind of adding two of them together. So it's kind of very simple local term. All right, so now we have a ground state where we indeed have deconfined excitations, and you can check the braiding and the charges and so on. So it's indeed the kind of a Z2 spin liquid for these bosons. So the final thing, we don't only want bosonic partons, we also want to be able to have fermionic partons. And this we can generate in some reasonably simple way by just combining the different kinds of defects. So now I'm combining one vortex defect and one dislocation defect. And for the second object, I'm combining the second type of dislocation defect and the anti-vortex of the other one. So if I've done that in some reasonably clever way, again, this combination, the combination of these two objects is local, and it has precisely the structure of a boson plus some, you know, e to the 2i theta. So it's some component of this boson operator over here. And so that's what I have. And now, going back again and translating the microscopic terms, this superfluid fixed point Hamiltonian and this density wave one, that are just turn out to be simple fermionic hopping terms. So what we have is now two kinds of fermions. They combine together to form the microscopic boson, just as expected for partons. These fermions can hop around. They couple to a gauge field. That's not so important. And if these coefficients are equal, then each of these fermions will form a Dirac dispersion. Right, so at the critical point, we have something which looks like a Dirac dispersion for these fermions. But again, there is this non-locus flux insertion operator, which means that these two fermions are actually coupled to a compact gauge field. Again, this is you know, nothing new. That's what we expect this QD3 to be. But you know, we can certainly reproduce it. And by having done so, we can again go to form gapped phases by just doing mean field theory essentially on these fermions. So the gap band structures, one can very simply describe them in this case by just the churn number for each of the bands. Right, they have two species, they don't tunnel to one another. So I have separate churn bands. Firstly, I can form a trivial insulator for each fermion species, just the churn number zero for both. And that will give me back just the VBS state in this case, or the density wave state. It's very simple. I can give some opposite churn numbers, so form a quantum spin Hall state. That will give me the Hamiltonian for the superfluid. I think, again, it's the expected one. I can take a generic one. I have different churn numbers. In this case, I have a chiral state. So that's kind of a way how to generate Hamiltonians for a very large number of chiral spin liquids. And finally, I can do kind of a paired state. It's not quite paired state because it's particle hole objects which I'm pairing, but otherwise it's BCS-like. And that again gives me, for any kind of pairing I'm going to write down, I'll get some Hamiltonian for a Z2 spin liquid. So that's kind of the overview of these phases. I have phases for these microscopic bosons, for these fermions, for these partons. And this is always to be understood. Take any Hamiltonian for in any phase over here, and you automatically get the other ones for free. And since in this case, this ones are the simple ones, these are all simple band structure or mean field phases. So you can just take the fermionic models, and for free you get both these guys over here, which are marginally more complicated, and these guys over here, which are quite a bit more complicated. All right, so that's the end. I'll just flash my outlook, and thank you. I don't know. I don't think so. I haven't. So you know, you may be able to do it and get non-abelian gauge fields with the Trans-Siemens term, because there you may be able to actually carry out this integration. But at the end of the day, all this relies on being able to perform the integral over the gauge field. And I don't know how to do that for non-abelian ones. So.
Might be the main point, but suppose I give you the key metrics of general kind of abelian topological phase. So do you have just a prescription to translate into a couple wire construction?
I mean, that's in principle yes, right? I mean, you know, if you kind of transcribe this, in this case, this initial step would be to transcribe this K matrix into some partons, which is pretty simple. And then once you have that, then you can get some coupled wire version of this. So in that sense, yes. And you know, of course, in this case, like if you want something more complicated, you can always, you know, make this hierarchically. I've shown you a construction of one boson into two bosons, and you can kind of, you know, keep going like that and get an arbitrary number of partons.
Yeah, so wondering if so this coupled wire approach to bosons is offering, it's great that you can recover, you know, the intrinsically 2D things this way, but I wonder if you try to think about fermions and say spinless fermions at half length through the coupled wire approach. Now the density wave state is going to be very similar, but
right.
When it melts, you know, you'll get a Fermi liquid.
Yeah, I mean the Fermi liquid is, I mean, the Fermi liquid is the one state that, you know, we don't, or I don't know how to describe in these coupled wires. I mean, unless you fermionize it, so.
Presumably, it's hard to describe it by starting from the only
right.
Liquid, but from the vortex point of view, maybe, I mean, what happens if you just repeat everything you were doing, but for fermions at half length?
I haven't tried that, so I don't know, but yeah, it's a good idea.
Maybe you'll end up with a Fermi liquid in disguise, which would be great.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, the vortices will become fermionic.
I mean, the vortex of the density wave is order parameter. Actually, I don't know what they'll become. I mean, yeah. So they're half of the charge, right?
The vortex half the charge? What do you mean?
I mean, the vortices of the density wave order. So they are these half charge vortices.
Right.
But the real charge, the unit charge is a fermion. I don't know what.
I mean, there are probably various different ways of doing it. If you wanted to symmetrically, you need some kind of semion type object, I guess, something like that, which is, you know, less pleasant. You can probably find a less symmetric way to have it as kind of boson and fermion.
Wait, presumably this coupling chain might give you some access, backdoor access from
the. So how can you elaborate more about this full SO2 symmetries?
I mean, that's something which, you know, which is hopefully going to be done in the future, and I have no idea how to do it right now. I mean, in principle, the technology is similar, right? You have ways of encoding this full SO2 symmetry in these coupled wires. So, you know, there's one may think that there's a way to perform some kind of duality operation on that object to get something out, but at this point, you know, I honestly have no idea.
Use the
non-abelian bosonization. That's what I meant. Yeah, exactly. You know, so but then things become a little bit more complicated because these simple expressions where I've written them down certainly don't work, right? Compared to the sum of things. And you can imagine that you have, you know, something that you write down an object which is kind of, you know, some matrix, matrix inverse, matrix, matrix inverse, and so on. It seems like a horrible object, but again, it has a structure that if you combine two neighboring ones of these guys, right, it will be something like this. So it will be a non-local object where certain combinations are actually local. So based on this one, it seems like there may be some room of actually doing that. But you know, that I don't know more than this two lines. So.
I have another technical question. Previously, you said, suppose you start from one set, which is really decoupled Lattice liquids, and you want to convert in terms of the composite fermion operators coupled to gauge field.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you can do this because you can calculate the partition functions on both sides and compare. When you calculate the partition function on the composite fermion side, how did you do that?
No, so, maybe I need to clarify something. It's not the partition function of the composite Fermi liquid, right? because it's a partition function which doesn't really have any couplings and so on going in there. So what I really can say is that for the specific action of the gauge field, I can say that whatever the partition function is for my composite fermion is identical to the one for the electrons. Like I don't actually evaluate the partition function directly. I just show that they are equivalent. Well, it's okay. So you know, I can try to go back.
The equivalent for composite fermions hopping in one dimension. Is that what you mean?
What do you mean by composite fermion hopping in one dimension? That's the idea, right? So I have some model over here. Now I can, in principle, add any hopping terms of this over here. They're not affected by this transformation. Right? So I can add any interwire couplings. They don't affect this. So all I can really say is that the kinetic energy of composite fermions and the gauge field, all the stuff together, is identical to the kinetic energy over there. Right? So that I know for sure. And then it follows that if I'm adding any coupling terms, those two theories are the same. But I can't solve any of these two theories if I have the cosines.
But here, is it really a Gaussian integral?
Sorry?
Is this really a Gaussian integral over?
This is a Gaussian integral, yeah. So everything's quadratic here, right?
But A really has many flux sectors. Do you need to consider that?
Yes, many flux sectors.
It's compact. Yeah. At this level, can you see that A is compact? Or is it just a number?
In this level, this A is just a number.
Any other questions? We can just speak again.